Any more announcements? No? Well, it was mentioned of Henry Gilmer, and I guess he's already gone off to the beach, so we're not going to get to see him for another week. We did see him on July 5th. We celebrated with some of the Gilmers on that day. You know, I look out over here, and it's good to see the horns here. Good to see everybody here, really, who could make it. And to say the least, Daryl's doing better, which is neat as well. There's a Chinese curse, which isn't a part of this. It's supposed to be a curse. May you live in interesting times. And I think, wow, we live in interesting times, to say the least. And it's a curse because, really, it's really a blessing to live in times that are not interesting, that are just nice, quiet, peaceful times. So these surely aren't that. The movie Schindler's List ends with the main character, Oscar Schindler, expressing his heartfelt regret that he did not do more to save Polish Jews during World War II. The ones he saved by hiring as workers. They worked in his factory. They were marked for certain death. Many of them were on their way when he intercepted them on their way to concentration camps in Poland. And in the course of the war, it's said that he saved the lives of 1,200 Jews. What began as a selfish search for cheap labor grew into a passion to save lives from what was called the Nazis' final solution. In order to get these people to divert them to his factory, he had to bribe people. He had to bribe officials with his own money. And at first, that seemed to pay off, but it got more and more expensive. Namely, had to bribe a Nazi official called Amon Gott. He was the commandant of the concentration camp in a nearby town in Poland. By the end of the war, this once greedy man, Schindler, is basically broke. And he's left with only a very few physical belongings. And there was a man, his right-hand man was named Isaac Stern, and he's listening as Schindler expresses his regrets. This is towards the end of the movie. And he says, I could have done more. I could have gotten more out. I don't know. I could have gotten a lot more out. And Oscar, or the guy next to him, Stern, says, Oscar, there are 1,100 people. Now, they credit him with 1,200, but Oscar says, or Isaac says, there are 1,100 people who are alive because of you. Look at them. And Schindler says, if I'd had more money, he's just thinking to himself and bemoaning these facts, I threw away so much money, you have no idea. And Stern says, there will be generations because of what you did. I didn't do enough, he answers. Oh, you did so much. And he looks over at his car. That car, he says, God would have bought that car. Why did I keep that car? 10 people, right there, 10 people, 10 more people. And then he notices he has a Nazi, he's a member of the Nazi party, and he has a lapel pin, a Nazi pin, and he removes it. He whispers, this pin, 2 people, this is gold, 2 more people. He would have given me 2 for it. Well, at least one more person, a person, Stern, for this. And he's sobbing by then. He says, I could have gotten one more person, and I didn't do it, and I just didn't do it. In the world where evil triumphed over good, Oscar Schindler was an exception. Evil people, though, seem to somehow float to the top almost any time you look at. Certainly the time of the prophet Malachi, and we're going to be spending some time in Malachi today. He lived in a time where evil seemed to prevail. And not only did it prevail, but those people seemed to prosper, as we'll see. In Malachi 3, starting in verse 1, it's a prophecy. Now, he's talking to exiles who've returned to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And he says this, the one you seek and the one who they desire, the one they delight in, is coming. And he explains what's going to happen. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. This is Malachi 3, verse 1 through 2. And then Malachi cautions in verse 2, but who can endure the day of his coming? For who shall stand when he appears? But you know, they've grown tired of waiting in the time of Malachi, much like any other time period you want to visit. They lost their faith in justice. They become bitter. They become complacent. And really, they had become indifferent to obedience. And so Malachi is going to address this bitterness that these people feel, this complacency. And in verse 14 of Malachi 3, It's written, "You have said it is futile to serve God. It's vain to serve God. What do we gain by carrying out his requirements and going about like mourners in sackcloth?" And he said, you know, they were really going around in fake sorrow. He says, what does it gain going around like mourners before the Lord Almighty? And in verse 15, "But now we call the arrogant proud." They looked around and said, look, the arrogant and the proud, we call them blessed. They're blessed. Certainly, they complained, evildoers prosper, and even when they put God to this test, they get away with it. Does that sound familiar? Evil, you see people prospering, and you know they're cheating, they're swindlers, they're dishonest. You know, where has Sabbath keeping gotten us? I study, I pray, I fast. What does it count for? When I look around me, I'm seeing these people who don't do even remotely those things prospering. Well, here's God's response in chapter 2, verse 17. If we drop back a chapter, chapter 2 of Malachi in verse 17, it says, "You have wearied the Lord with your words." Another word for that is that you've exhausted him. But you ask, how have we wearied him? By saying, all who do evil are good in the eyes of God, and he is pleased with them. What? That's quite an accusation that God is pleased with evil, which the two can't coexist, God and evil. In the King James Version, it says he delights in them. He delights in these evil people. They were so fed up with watching them prosper that they thought, God must be pleased with them. He must be delighting in them. And so then they ask this critical question, where is the God of justice? Where is the God of judgment? You know, the idea that we can look around our neighborhood and tell who God is pleased with is pretty ridiculous. You know, Malachi made it clear in chapter 1 that these were people, the priests on down, the ministry on down, they did not want justice. That was the last thing they wanted. They brought in all kinds of these polluted offerings. And God asked something, it's an affront to God, and he says, you know, would you even give those offerings to a governor? Would the leader of your country, would he even accept those? And they're expecting God to accept them. Well, you know, this same theme would prevail 400 years later, this idea that evil people prosper. And it weaves its way throughout, really, the entire Bible. They were simply observing what was around them. In Ecclesiastes 9, verse 1 through 3, you don't have to turn there. It says in the NIV, all share a common destiny. In other words, everybody, if you look around you, you'll see that they all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean. Those who offer sacrifices, we can't tell those from people who don't. People who are good, people who are evil, people who make promises, people who swear oaths. We can't tell those from people who obey God. None now knows God's love or hatred by all that is before them. In other words, if you were to look out there and drive up and down your street and try to figure out, based on what they've got in their garage and what their house looks like, you couldn't tell who God loves and who he doesn't, or who loves God and who doesn't. Groucho Marx had a joke. I found this morning. It's a joke I've always liked. I thought it was Groucho, and I said it's Chico, but he said, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? I think he was talking to his wife. But at any rate, God says, you know, you can't always believe your eyes. You can't always believe what you see when you look around. Prosperity is not a very reliable indicator of obedience. And there's a danger, and that is that it prevents character development if we're not careful. In the most prosperous world, in the most prosperous time in the history of mankind, and character, of course, is what's necessary, what God wants. These are prophetic times in Malachi. He's a prophet. He's talking about when Christ comes back. And in chapter 3, again, verse 2, he says, there are some neat analogies for when Christ comes back, and all of them conjure up fear, they probably should. He said, he shall be like a refiner's fire, you know, that makes jewelry, fine gold, and melts it down and gets rid of the impurities, and launders soap, where he gets rid of, you know, dirt, things that are stuck to fine cloth. Job uses a much more scary example of the heaven and earth being shaken. It says the wicked are going to be shaken out of their complacency, out of their grasp on these worldly things. So if you haven't developed character, it's going to be hard to hang on. to such things. Matthew 3, it warns of Jesus coming back. It uses the example of a fan, a big, huge fan in God's hand, and it's just going to fan the wheat and separate the chaff. When I was a kid in Washington State, my dad used to go down by the river, and there was Longview was a port city, and a lot of grain came from Washington State, from the eastern side, mainly wheat. And there'd be big piles of it. When the ships came and picked it up, there'd be piles left. They weren't big piles to them, but to us, it was a big pile. And my dad would get 50-pound bags of free wheat. And we would have to get the chaff out of them. And you'd do, on a windy day, you'd drop the wheat, and the chaff would just blow away into the grass, and it would disappear. And you couldn't find it. We didn't really look for it. But it's somewhat of a haunting picture to think of this big fan separating out those people that don't have character and haven't built it from those who have. In the midst of this great prosperity, the question is, how can we be sure? How can we be sure that we're going to be among those that remain? That we're not spots that are going to be removed, that we're not blemishes, that we're not chaff, that we're not so loosely holding on to the things that are important that we're shaken loose. You know, in Malachi 2, verse 17, it says, where is the God of justice and judgment, as I mentioned? And then there's an answer, and it's in this prophecy. And God says in chapter 3, verse 5 of Malachi, so I will come to put you on trial. I'll be quick to testify against. Against who? Those who do the following. And it's kind of a mixture, a list, and this is where I want to get into the heart of this sermonette, or this sermon. Those who do the following, sorcerers, that sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? Adulterers, I had a young lady in my office yesterday who had kind of a satanic shirt on, and apparently she likes music that's really, and she admitted it's really dark. Satanic, so people who are sorcerers, yes, those are people that Jesus at his return will testify against. Adulterers, perjurers, people who lie, people who defraud the laborers of their wages. And then we get to something that seems to be a little less, I don't say less bad, but more realistic, who oppress the widows and the fatherless. Deprive foreigners, people that come among you and need help and you don't do it. If you do these things, he says, you should be fearful. Well, the prophecy of Judgment Day is going to discern between two groups of people, and there will be only two. And it's very easy to think that we'll make the cut, you know? That delusion is so common. In Proverbs 16, verse 2, it says, all the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives. And we can't always look at people and tell what motivates them. Some people do things really good for really bad reasons, and some people do really bad things for good reasons. When Jesus was a baby, he was brought to the temple. Simeon, remember, just wanted to live long enough to see Jesus. And Simeon speaks about the impact, the future impact of Christ's ministry. And he says this in Luke 2, that the thoughts of many hearts might be revealed, that one of the purposes of Jesus' ministry was to really show what is in people's hearts and in their minds. And it's in Matthew 25 where we're going to spend some time now, because it's three parables that really fulfill this getting at the heart of who we are. And there's three parables. I'm going to go spend time on one of them. Gandhi said a man is a product of his thoughts. And this is really what this parable that I'm going to talk about is really about, what we're thinking. What it is that is really deep down inside our minds, how we spend our time. The three parables, we're familiar with them, the 10 virgins, it's about preparing, it's about preparation, it's about using the time that God gives us to know him, to get to know him, to understand him, to really ask of that Holy Spirit, to invite it into us. The parable of the talents is the next parable, it's about using our time to develop our talents. And then the last of these is called the least of these. And this addresses eternity. If you just read through this parable, I'm going to read through it, and then we're going to talk about some things. But if you just read through this parable, it's a little bit mind-boggling. It's a little scary. Because, they, as I mentioned, there's only two categories of people, and this particular parable separates them out very definitively. When the Son of Man comes, in verse 31 of Matthew 25, and I'm going to read basically through this parable. It's very familiar, so I won't spend a lot of time hashing out each part of it. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory. And in verse 32, all the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. Now, He says, these are the two categories. There's sheep, they're represented by sheep and goats. And in verse 33, and He will set the sheep on the right hand and the goats on the left. And this is actually a quote from Ezekiel 34, verse 17. Behold, I judge between cattle and cattle, and rams and goats, sheep and goats. In verse 34, then the king will say to those on the right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And you can spend a lot of time talking about sheep and goats. The Gilmers are much more expert about sheep than I am. I was on a sheep ranch for a week one time. Did not make me an expert, but taught me a fair amount about sheep. And there's a couple things about sheep that are really obvious, and I won't go into great detail, but a sheep needs a shepherd. There's no two ways about it. They need help. They're pretty pathetic. We got them out of all kinds of scrapes during that week. We didn't have a big dog like David and them have that was kept order. We pretty much kept order. And by morning, they were in trouble just like they had been the morning before oftentimes. They need somebody to lead them. They need a shepherd. Goats, on the other hand, we've had goats before when I was a kid, totally independent. They lead. They don't need a leader. They lead. Adam Clark said in his commentary, he sums it up pretty well. He says, sheep, which have ever been considered as the emblems of mildness, simplicity, patience, and usefulness. I don't know how mild. I got banged in the head with a few of them a few times. Patience and usefulness, they represent here the genuine disciples of Christ. And goats, he said, are naturally quarrelsome, lascivious, and excessively ill-scented. That's true if you've been around goats. Considered the symbols of riotous, profane, and impure men. If you get on the UCG website, they brought out something that was pretty neat, I thought, that throughout history in parts of Asia and Africa, there are sheep and goats that you cannot tell apart. They're separating them out is almost impossible unless you, it's like twins. Until you've been around them a lot, sometimes identical twins, they can be very difficult. And then once you've been around them, you can separate them. But for the average person, it's really hard to tell. And they're saying from that, you can't judge people by outward conformity. It's misleading. There's something that only Jesus is going to be able to discern. It says, but the Lord weighs the motives, if you remember what I read earlier. And it's going to take God to determine the difference between those two groups of people. In the only parable about the final judgment, this is it, Jesus proceeds to make it very clear who is going to be on the right and who is going to be on the left. Verse 35, for I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. Food, drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. You took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick. You visited me. I was in prison and you visited me. You came by and saw me. These are all basic. What's so interesting to me about it, they're all basic things that anybody can do without exception. Every one of these is something the average person can do. And then in verse 37, the righteous will answer saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you drink? Verse 38, when did we see you a stranger and take you in or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? In verse 39. You notice the people that have done this are shocked. They're surprised. They're unconscious of the things that they've done that were good. They weren't expecting anything in return. They did it in the spirit of they were doing good solely for the sake of doing good. In Malachi 3, verse 10, he said, this was God's intention from the very beginning. Not a cup of cold water given for the honor of God shall lose its reward. So this isn't something Jesus came up with that was brand new. It was something that God had intended all along, and Jesus simply clarified. In verse 40, Matthew 25 again, and the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it for me. And then he'll talk to those on the left hand in verse 41, "Depart from me, you cursed. The righteous are called the blessed of my Father, for their blessedness is owing purely," get this, "to the grace of God and his blessing." Nothing that we can talk about how great we are is something that is by God's grace that we do it. "But the wicked are called only ye cursed, for their damnation is of themselves into the everlasting fire." Now, what's interesting is that, you know, heaven was basically prepared. It was a place prepared for the saints. But look who this was prepared for from the beginning. It says, the everlasting fire in verse 41, prepared for the devil and his angels. It was a fire that was prepared for not wicked people necessarily, but for these people who just didn't do some of the things God wanted. Or I'm sorry, not for them, but for Satan, for his demons. But they're going to suffer the same fate. And that's the scary part. So verse 42, "For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. Verse 43, I was a stranger and you did not take me in. Naked, you did not clothe me. And in prison, you did not visit me." Then they all answer him saying, they're just as shocked. They didn't do these things. "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister you? When did we do that?" And in verse 45, he answers, "And then he answered them saying, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these," the least of these, we'll hear throughout, they're the least dignified, the least noble. "If you didn't do it to them, you didn't do it to me. I suffered, where were you?" The sin of omission, what we don't do, what we didn't do, carries an incredible burden. And in many ways, a greater burden than the things that we did wrong that we repent of. In verse 46, "And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life." That's pretty incredible. That's our destiny. That's eternity, either punishment or life. Some have called this passage the noblest passage in the Gospels. We're going to talk about nobility for a bit. The least of these, the least noble. There's a phrase I came across called noblesse oblige. How many of you have ever heard that term? Noblesse, yeah, of course, our semanticist out here, a couple people shaking their head. Noblesse oblige. I first heard about it, or first heard it on Mary Poppins. If you remember, Mr. Banks is singing, and he says, "I'm the lord of my castle, the sovereign, the liege. I treat my subjects, servants, children, wife, with a firm but gentle hand. Noblesse oblige." I had to look it up. I had no idea what it meant. It was first used back in 1837. It's been around all this time by a French novelist, and I still maybe have heard of it. But I heard it there, and it really piqued my attention. And it was in a letter that this novelist wrote. "To be sure, if noblesse oblige, royalty must do still more." Well, what it means is that nobility has an obligation. Nobility obligates. Now, think about in the early 1800s. This was not long after the late 1700s, in which we had a French Revolution. And what happened to the nobles? They had their heads cut off, didn't they? They lost their heads. Perhaps if they practiced noblesse oblige, a lot more of them would have remained alive. It means that privileged people who have more, are to act with a certain generosity towards the less privileged. It is the noble thing to do. This morning I came across something that said that when George H.W. Bush died, this was something they said he'd modeled his life after. This idea they credited him, which is a pretty incredible thing to say about somebody when they die. But it's something we are to be deserving of as Christians. We are to be, one, we are privileged to live in this country, certainly, and with that comes additional obligations. In Genesis 41, is perhaps the earliest example of this. I'll paraphrase it. It has to do with Joseph, his dream, where there's 7 years. He had a dream, or the king had a dream, and Joseph said, well, it says there's going to be 7 prosperous years, there's going to be 7 lean years, that there's going to be a famine for 7 years. And he recommended to the king that, or the Pharaoh, that the people live frugally for those 7 prosperous years. They might even ration. set aside grain during those abundant times. Now, the Pharaoh could have said, okay, I'm going to make sure that royalty has enough grain, that we have enough for the nobles, the royal court. We must make sure they have enough. He could have exempted his own court from thriftiness, but instead, he made the rules apply to everyone. In chapter 41 of Genesis, verse 40, the Pharaoh, speaking to Joseph, says, "You shall be in charge of my palace. And all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." So he didn't exempt himself really from anything or his court. The same applied to everybody. It was for the benefit of everyone. In verse 57 of the same chapter, Genesis 41, it says, "Moreover, all the world came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine became severe throughout the land." They didn't hoard it. He didn't keep maybe enough for him. I remember reading, I think it was Chesterton, who said, "One of the biggest things that keep us from giving is fear. We're afraid. We're afraid." And so here's a Pharaoh who stepped out and made it so that everybody had enough. Joseph would later practice this same noblesse oblige with his brothers when they came to him for wheat, for grain. And what did he do? He gave them the best. He gave them the best he had to offer, the best of food and forgiveness. In Amos 6, verse 1, it refers to people who are comfortable, physically, spiritually comfortable, so comfortable that they're not concerned about those who aren't comfortable. He calls them those that are at ease in Zion. Those that are at ease in Zion. We're not supposed to be at ease in the United States. There should be things that prick our conscience daily. If you watch the news, if you listen, I listen to podcasts, and the enslavement of people around the world is incredible. We're burning up parts of our cities because we used to have slaves 150 years ago. These people are truly enslaved, and in some cases, there are ways to get them out if people who have more lend a hand and lend money. Jeremiah said that such people that live like that are in houses full of deceit. Now that's pretty, and this isn't my purpose to sound so critical, because when you think of our prosperity, it just sometimes it does prick your conscience. But Jeremiah said there are people here who he called them great and rich men. He said they were great and rich men, and they're wicked, and they're prosperous. So he said right there, he said, okay, that can be exist side by side, rich, prosperous, but wicked. He saw that. He saw through that. In verse 28, who have grown fat and sleek. He said, don't believe your eyes when you see these people. They do not. This is the reason he condemned them so greatly as being wicked. They do not promote the case of the fatherless. They do not defend the just cause of the poor. That's the reason these people who live in houses of deceit, they think because they're comfortable, the rest of the world is comfortable. We were in Jekyll Island recently. Got to visit a good friend of mine and take my whole family. And he had this big, long, sprawling house just off the beach. And we got to bicycle. I was at the feast in Jekyll, like some of you have been. I was there many times, and I never bicycled, never got inland and saw the beauty of that island. It is an incredible place. The Jekyll Island Club, which I presume you all have seen, is a sprawling Victorian manor. It is a beautiful hotel, built in the late 1800s for some of the richest, the richest, most powerful families in America. Names like the Astors, the Cornings, the Goodyears, Macy's, Morgans, Pulitzers, Rockefellers, Vanderbilts. Andrew Carnegie's brother, David, I can't think of his name, but anyway, he lived in they owned a big chunk, if not all, of the Cumberland Island that's just off of the coastline of Jekyll Island. And so he spent time there. When he was there and they were all there together for dinner, they represented more than 1/6 of the entire wealth of the world, sitting around one big, nice table. I was curious about Andrew Carnegie when I came back from being down there, because Andrew Carnegie exemplifies the true spirit of noblesse oblige. He essentially gave away his entire wealth. And some of you, if you're like me and you're a reader, you've benefited from his donations. From his book, The Gospel of Wealth, it was written over 130 years ago, he wrote this: "The man of wealth should consider all surplus revenues which come to him simply as trust funds." He lived off really a small percentage of his fortune every year. Gave himself a, I mean, he was wealthy, and it was a nice living, don't get me wrong, but he didn't lack for anything. But a trust fund is something that you hold for the benefit of others. And he said, you know what? That excess wealth, that's where it should be. He was a billionaire by today's standards, and he left his wife, Andrew Carnegie, or Carnegie, or Carnegie, or what is there all kinds of ways to say it. He left his wife and his daughter their personal belongings. He left them a house. He left them a summer home and a modest amount of money. He left also a trust for his daughter. Their home was just too much to keep up. They couldn't afford to keep up their home, and so they ended up selling it. Just enough to be comfortable. And the rest of the money he took, and he funded 200 libraries, Carnegie Mellon University, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York. He wrote this later. He said, "The day is not far distant when the man who dies, leaving behind millions of available wealth, which was free for him to administer during his life, he could have done something with it and he didn't, will pass away unwept, unhonored, and unsung." He famously added this line, for which he's known: "The man who dies rich dies disgraced." This was for him the solution for the poor. The problem of the rich and the poor, this was how you settled it out. The English word noble comes from the Latin word nobilis, and its root is G-N-O, know. It means to know something. And in its original ancient usage, it meant someone whose name and reputation were well known, a celebrated man of renown. It's not hard to imagine that it included those who were generous. They were known for their generosity. See, it's noble. It's noble to be known for your generosity. It wasn't until later, the Roman Republic, sometime in there, that nobility came to mean people who were born to a certain status or a certain rank. But really, we all are, if you think about it. Little Henry is born to a noble status. If you're born in the United States, you're born to noble status, to say the least. When it was said of the Bereans in Acts 17, verse 11, that they were more noble than those in Thessalonica, it meant they had this incredible understanding to know more, to understand more, this desire for understanding of what Paul was talking about. But it was also not just a desire to know, it was a desire also to share that with people. They were generous in sharing their knowledge with people. Do you know that the official motto of the student organization, National Honor Society, that's their motto, that's their official motto, is noblesse oblige, oblige. In other words, you're supposed to share this talent for knowledge, this acquisition of knowledge that you have with other people. You're supposed to share those gifts. And really, the parable of gifts, the talents, preceded this. And really, it's a good lead-in, because that's one of the things you're supposed to share with people. You're supposed to give. If you've got a gift and you can enrich other people's lives with it, then you should. Amanda got up and left before the last song, and it was amazing how all of a sudden, I could hear Samuel, which wasn't good, but no, I'm kidding. But no, you could hear this, yeah, it was like this little vacuum, this you know, that was left behind. There's a talent there that must be shared. You know, as Carnegie gave away his incredible wealth, and these were mainly buildings of concert halls and libraries and universities, there was this one caveat that went with it. There was one rule that went with it, a requirement for those on the receiving end. Each time he gave a community money, they had to do something to contribute. It's very important that they have what he would call skin in the game. In many towns and cities, he built libraries, And he required that those communities, those people, take their own personal books and contribute them to those libraries. I used to walk, we lived in Albany, Oregon. We lived next to the Willamette River. It seemed like we always lived next to a river. And it was a couple miles to the library. We had one car, and oftentimes my sisters and I would walk to the library. That library was a Carnegie library. He donated money to start that library. And what's amazing is these libraries still get pretty good sums of money every year. Johnson City Library is a Carnegie library, and so is the one at Lincoln Memorial, where my sons have gone to medical college. So we're still living off the largesse, the generosity of this man who's added a certain quality to our lives. Well, as much as we want it to be, God requires pretty much the same thing. In Luke 6, verse 30, he says, when we give something away, and what I meant to say really is that we're not to expect something in return. It doesn't mean you don't expect that people do something, but really, Jesus laid out, he put the bar so high that we go, well, it's impossible. But this is what he says in Luke 6, verse 30. Give to everyone that asks. Lend, expecting nothing in return. Even to your enemies, he says. In verse 35, these are enemies, hateful people. Expect nothing in return. And he says, and your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High. For he says, he set the example, is kind to the ungrateful and to the selfish. Be merciful even as your Father is merciful. Now, this doesn't mean you neglect your family. It starts at home. You have to provide for your family first and foremost. You have to provide for church brethren, and then it expands from there. In Ephesians 4, verse 28, Paul is writing about a new way of thinking and a new way of living. And Paul brought to a pagan world, and it was so universal, so incredibly transformative, what he wanted to begin to educate these people to do. And so it's in a time of incredible selfishness and dishonesty. And he says you have to quit that. You have to quit stealing. You have to quit being dishonest. You've got to quit doing the things you're doing. But he said that's not enough. It's not enough to not do bad things. It's not enough to not steal from your neighbor. It's not enough to not lie to your neighbor. He says there's more. If you notice, the sheep were doing something. They weren't just refraining from doing evil. They were doing something. And so Paul is saying there's got to be something in the place of these bad habits. So in Ephesians 4, verse 28, he says, anyone who has been stealing must steal no longer. Is that enough? Okay, I haven't stolen anything, I don't think, in a long time. But he says, but they must work. They must work doing something useful with their own hands, what's the purpose of that? That they may have something to share with those in need. Paul is saying that you must become an honest employee, become a productive part of society, not simply to take away the incentive to steal. You don't want to just have a lot because you don't want to steal. It's not a temptation, but so you can do something for the less fortunate. It is a fundamental lesson that labor is honorable. It's one of the most fundamental reasons labor is honorable. It's because it enables you to help other people. Now, my parents were poor, as I've mentioned. We didn't help anybody with money, although my dad would give away stuff that really we needed. But they gave away their time, they helped people, they served in other ways. So it's not just about money, that's for sure. But C.S. Lewis said of this passage, the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. That was his theory. The great obstacle, he said, is fear. We mentioned that. I actually attribute that to somebody else. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, okay. He said that fear and that insecurity keeps us, he said, from doing that. He said we should give more than we can even spare. There ought to be things we should like to do, he said, and cannot because our charitable expenditures exclude them. It's neat to take, to go places. It's neat to do things. But he's saying there's times where maybe if you didn't do that, there are people you could benefit more. Some time back, we were leaving our office, Deborah and I, and we were going to meet a couple people at a restaurant, a local restaurant. They'd come by our office earlier that day, as they had on several occasions, and Deborah determined that she was going to give them something on these occasions, but she didn't want to give them money, per se. They needed food, and she said, well, I'll buy you food. I'll buy you groceries. She's met them at this restaurant a number of times. And it's a favorite restaurant of theirs. So on this particular day, as we drove over to meet them, we went past an intersection. And in that intersection was a guy with a sign. He's there all the time, or routinely. And as we went by, we kind of, went past him. There was no way to stop it. It occurred to me, am I doing the right thing? Are we doing the right thing? Are we helping these people? And I'm always conflicted. It's always a difficult question. And then, you that ring in the back, give to anyone, everyone who asks. Jesus doesn't qualify it with, well, they'll probably use it on drugs, they'll probably use it for something nefarious, they probably won't use it for cigarettes, they'll probably use it for something like that. G.K. Chesterton, speaking of which, said, I'd rather risk giving to the wrong person than not giving to someone who is truly in need, Jesus himself. Well, my family were the beneficiaries of Noblesse Oblige more than once. We drove, when I lived in Longview, Washington, 50 miles to the church in Portland. And during the winter, we always got back home after dark. And on more than one occasion, but one in particular, there were boxes, not just one, boxes of groceries in our porch. You could barely make them out. There's something on the porch. And we all excitedly, when we realized it's food, it was one of those moments you never forget. And I remember one particular time, it was all this abundant. It was stuff we would never get. We always got the bare necessities, a lot of pinto beans, a lot of cheese. We had farms, we had a lot of canned foods. But just the bare, when we got, like A&W root beer, that was like, woo, that was a big deal. But I remember in this box, one of these boxes was a can of enchiladas. I mean, that was like from outer space. My parents would never, they were not, and we opened the can thinking, what's this going to be like? There weren't Mexican restaurants in every corner at that time. But I remember them being so unique a taste. And so, we just kind of paced ourselves. It was a big can. There were nine of us, though, so it didn't go very far. But I'll never forget that. I wasn't embarrassed. I was appreciative of somebody in our neighborhood was good enough, was kind enough, was thoughtful enough to give something to the Green family. We came home on another occasion. I think I've told you about that. There was a TV sitting on our porch. We'd never had a TV, and I was probably at that time about nine, old enough to yearn for a TV. And the TV, we didn't even get it set up, and it disappeared. And it's like, hey, where's the TV? And Mom traded in on two violins and an accordion. My sisters learned how to play the violin. My brother learned how to play the accordion. By the time I was big enough to hold the accordion, we'd already moved and left it behind with somebody else. But nonetheless, that kind of gives you an idea of the values of my parents. We lived in other places where we were even more poor when we were waiting for Social Security. And people in Idaho brought us venison. I remember hunters, neighbors cooked meals. My parents never told anybody, we need food. They just, people figured it out. I don't know if we just looked that craven, that hungry, what it was. But people figured it out. They were intuitive. We were invited to pluck chickens. Some friends in the church had about 100 chickens. My dad and mom helped them pluck and prepare these chickens. And then they gave them chickens. And we picked fruit. We picked up potatoes. In Idaho, you could go out and pick up potatoes. The machines didn't left behind. People in the church are always telling us, hey, it usually involved work. I will say that. It often involves something that we had to do. But out of it came incredible fruit and vegetables, wonderful things. The final judgment is a fearful thing in many ways. But it can motivate us. Back to Malachi, if we go back to Malachi 3 and verse 16. In Malachi 3, verse 16, it says, Then they that feared the Lord talked often to each other. They were encouraging each other. They were sharing things with each other, like the Bereans, sharing the stuff they learned. We come together each week and we converse and we share. And we're supposed to kind of lift each other up. That's part of fearing God, is to converse about important things. You know, it's so interesting that right before this, it was recording how much people were complaining about everybody prospering. And then God says, you know who's going to be blessed? Those people who come together and they talk. What are they talking about? God, really. And the Lord listened and he heard it. Their conversations he heard. It says, then they who feared the Lord talked often to each other, and the Lord listened and heard it. He heard that specific conversation. And as a result of that conversation, this is what happened. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and did what? They responded to that fear, that thought upon his name. You know, Paul encouraged us to habitually think of God. Think upon God habitually, all the time. And this is the way he says it, a scripture most of us have memorized, Philippians 2:5. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus. Let it happen. Let it happen. It will happen. The NIV says it, for my purposes, even better. In your relationships with one another, now this is Philippians 2:5. In your relationships with one another, that's what we're talking about, relationships here, with one another, have the mindset, the same mindset as Jesus Christ. When you're dealing with people, have this mind in you when you talk to each other. When you think about fearing me and it motivates you to talk to people, share things with them that will buoy them, will help them. It's not just about giving them money, that's for sure, or giving them stuff. In verse 17 of Malachi 3, talking about those that thought upon his name, they shall be mine. It's an incredible verse. Says the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, remember the fire that fired up the gold and melted it down, and the soap that got out the bad spots, and the wind that blew away the debris, and then the analogy of shaking, that there's incredible shaking. He says, these people are going to get through all of that, and as a result, they're going to be they're my jewels, but they're made by him. And he says, and I will spare them. And in a way that we can understand, as a man spares his son that serves him. One of the most incredible things about being a parent is to have sons that serve. And really, the way they serve is they spend time with, they help. And to have a son, Morgan and I have been working on a balcony, we've been working on painting for this week. And Caleb is off doing other things, goofing around. But no, I'm kidding, he's actually at work. And Morgan, on his vacation, we put him to work, and there's something incredible. It says, I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. It's a really beautiful picture. In the final scene of Schindler's List, the war is over, and Oskar Schindler, because he's a member of the Nazi party, remember the pin, is regarded as a war criminal. And the Allies are coming in, and they're going to be after people like him. So he's preparing to flee. And his employees have gotten together. And they give him a gold ring. Not just any gold ring, but it's a gold ring that's made from the fillings of their teeth. They pull their teeth, and they took the gold out of them. They've melted it down. And it's all they have. They don't have anything. Everything they've had, they have, except their life, is gone. And here's the man who saved their lives. And of course, they want to do what they can to thank him. Inside this band, engraved in this, is a quotation from the Talmud. And this, they read it to him. They said, now, inside this is from the Talmud, which is their holy book. They're reading this to a Nazi. Whosoever saves one life saves the world. You know, Jim Elliot is from Portland, Oregon, or was from Portland, Oregon. I guess he's still from Portland, Oregon. He was a missionary. And he went to minister to a terribly poor area. He went to save the most desperately poor people, these Huarani, the people of Ecuador. Jim Elliot understood that you know what, this Christian life is about service, but it's not about getting anything in return necessarily. In other words, you risk everything. As a Christian, you risk not getting anything back in return. He wrote somewhat famously this sentence: "He is a fool," and I don't remember when I read this, a long time ago, but I love the sentiment. "He is a fool," I'll get it right here. "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose." Jim Elliot would die in Ecuador. He wasn't even 29 years old. The great things in life, paradoxically, can only be kept by giving them away. Isn't that incredible? By sharing them. I'm going to close with this from Goethe. He said, "You can easily judge the character of a man by how he treats those who can do nothing for him." Jesus called them the least of these, the ignoble. And brethren, how we spend eternity, our destiny, is determined by how we treat those people.